One. This is Anna Levy at, excuse me, Adam Lubinsky on August 25th, part two of Education Narratives Oral History Project. I'm going to go ahead and start and ask you how this summer has been compared to previous summers, both as a professional who works in education and also as a parent who has a child who is in school.
Yes, two children, actually.
Oh.
Anyway, great to have another round of interviews with the Oral History Summer School. So this summer, definitely unusual. And I returned to Brooklyn about a week and a half ago. We were in Brooklyn from mid-March. Well, we were in Brooklyn and left in mid-May, you know, but we're in here in Brooklyn during the pandemic for about 9 weeks, and then left for 3 months. Just got back a week and a half ago. And so on both a personal level, and then also I'll talk about the professional work, it's definitely been new kinds of things. You know, on a personal level, we went and stayed in Western Massachusetts with friends who have a little guest house on their property in the woods. You know, definitely a very fortunate space to be in for that time. Our friends have three kids, two of which are the same age as our kids. So they were really able to, you know, be pretty self-sufficient during the day, hanging out with each other. You know, I basically worked remotely. One of the things that was kind of interesting about it was we tend to go out to Massachusetts in the summer anyway and stay with these friends. And our kids attend a summer camp, a day camp that I started with the friend that we stay with. And so it's now 30 summers in. That's actually how I know Suzanne. She was a counselor there many, many years ago. But one of the things that was really interesting is that the current director of the camp, who I still know, and my older child has been going there for a few summers now. He had to go virtual for the summer. But originally he called me right before we left for Massachusetts and said that he was going to have to cancel camp for the summer. So I spent a large part of my, you know, first weeks in Massachusetts helping him plan a virtual camp, which was really very successful. And so my kids and my friend's kids, so there are four kids doing this virtual camp. And actually tonight, they're having a kind of broader debrief for educators to talk about what they did, the platform they set up, and the work they did. So I sent that information to Suzanne and Jenny. I don't know if either of them are attending. I'm not attending because I'm on with you. But that was really interesting. And so long-winded, you know, I'm not really an educator now. I work with schools and school districts. But I, you know, in a way I sort of started off as one. My father was a superintendent of schools for 25 years and then ran an educational foundation. And before I went and did architecture and urban planning, I started this summer camp, and that was definitely an experiment in pedagogy and education, and also taught for a year in South Africa. You know, I pivoted. I went on to do work in architecture and urban planning, but my work has really, a lot of it now is working with school districts. And that is involved in essentially school planning. A lot of it relates to issues around school integration. some of that is looking at assignment policies and sort of spatial neighborhood dynamics. So there is an urban planning angle to it. And then some of it's looking at the facilities and seeing how many kids fit and, you know, how when you begin to move, think about, you know, where kids go differently, it obviously affects the facilities. And so that's work that I've been doing for a number of years now. And we have a number of projects that stopped this spring in both New York City and Maryland that were projects that related to sort of school diversity and equity issues. And of course, the work stopped right as all of these really meaningful issues were arising. So it was kind of a funny dynamic. But the work tends to have a lot of community engagement associated with it. And so very hard to do real community engagement, both virtually or, you know, in person, you know, when the pandemic was going on and schools were in such flux. So my work with schools, a lot of it really stopped during this time. But we started working on a couple of things, one which is not totally complete, so I can't really talk about it much, unfortunately, and I haven't even seen the final results of it, but was looking at a district that I've been very involved with, District 15 in Brooklyn, looking at the impacts of virtual learning on middle school students. And so we were interviewing principals and parents, essentially, to get a sense of how that was going. Another project that I got involved with this summer, which was very different than I would normally get involved with, was helping a charter school do a kind of reopening plan for, you know, the fall. And so some of that's been physical and some of that's been operational planning, mostly looking at essentially how kids queue up and enter the school. And so we designed something called a front porch for the school. And that's, you know, covered and creates that kind of way for kids to queue up, have their temperatures checked. So they've developed a pretty sophisticated way of, you know, checking students. And I actually biked by there this morning to have a look at it, and staff are starting to come in. So they're using it for the staff, which was really nice to see. So that was a little bit long-winded, but it definitely has been a different personal and professional summer. Personally, moving out of the city, I haven't lived outside of a city in 25 years, but also personally kind of re-engaging with pedagogy in a way, like thinking through what this virtual camp would look like, which was a lot of fun. And then professionally, having a lot of the work that I was doing with school stop, and then a couple of these new projects start up.
There's a lot in there. I'm actually going to go back to the summer camp and your reconnection with pedagogy.
Yes.
How did you think through the days? What is summer camp like when everything is online? Who are the counselors? Where do they come from? What are the goals for the kids in this moment? You know, how was that experience separate from you as a planner?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and certainly, you know, all of the credit really goes to the current director. I was sort of providing support in many ways. And one of the reasons why I was in touch with Suzanne and the Oral History Summer School was because so much of the work that I'm doing now is very systems based and looks at, it's very far from the kind of curricular and pedagogical issue. So I've been, but they're related, and I want to make them more related and build those connections. And so in a kind of ideal way, get to a point where a lot of the school planning work can be informed by and have a kind of synergistic relationship between pedagogy and then all of these sort of broader neighborhood contextual and planning related issues. So that's been a kind of goal of mine anyway. And then getting involved with the camp and the discussions about the camp, you know, really brought a lot of that back. Of course, it's camp, so it's a little different than school. But, you know, in essence, this day camp, which, again, I started, it's in its 30th summer, so it started at 29 years ago. One of the things that was always really special about it is that the staff all lived together, and the kids would go home. And the staff was, very young. So, I'm not sure I'd tolerate it now. But one of the things that the director did, which was fantastic, was essentially create arrangements for the staff to kind of quarantine together near where the camp is usually held, in an old Quaker center up in the sort of hills in Deerfield, Massachusetts. And so that was just kind of a brilliant stroke to be able to do that. Now, they did have some bandwidth problems, which is an infrastructure issue, but I think that immediately gave them, such a capacity to connect with each other, even as their ability to connect with kids was really limited. But I think, in talking through, what this camp would look like, I mean, there are all sorts of aspects to it, from the kind of basic, like, is it free? Do they pay? Like, how does that work? And sort of helping think through those things. But then getting to the platform, a lot of it was really trying to imagine what worked and what was special about the camp in person, and how to kind of create this portal. And in fact, we called it the portal into a kind of virtual world that did similar things. And I think it was really successful. And so the camp itself, it has a degree of structure where kids are choosing classes each day, but then have one block class that continues throughout the entire 3-week session. And each day typically would begin, and like the structure is exactly the same as we created 30 summers ago, which is really amazing. But the sort of act of staff planning and announcing those classes was always such a big celebration. And then the kids sort of deciding and signing up. So that was always like a big part of the camp, and it was part of the structure of the camp. And they were able to do that kind of performative presentation of the classes over Zoom really well. And this was sort of like, there were portals within portals. There was a kind of Google Classroom structure and then Zoom links within it. But then the camp always had this kind of informal time where there was downtime, and kids would hang out in this space called the, dumb name, but I always called it the Schmooze Room. And so the platform had this kind of formal structural space where it would show the classes and the staff could present their classes. And then there was this informal space where kids could click into this portal called the Schmooze Room and have a lot of that informal messing around space as well. And then within that, there were gallery spaces where kids could post their work. And so, I think the platform itself did as best it could to kind of capture the informal and formal sides of things. And they also did a lot of things which was like kind of make it more laid back, so kids didn't have to be on screens for quite as long. And then I think a lot of the focus groups, which were the big extended 3-week periods, those wound up having a little bit more of a, obviously, an independent quality to them. And I think they kind of accepted that and didn't try and force group work among kids who were unfamiliar with each other. And some of the work that came out was just really, really beautiful. And the kids are older, so they're 11 to 16, and so able to kind of process things a little bit more. I wish I could show you some things, but a lot of video work, a lot of sort of making work that led to video work. Some of it very poignant, about the experience of isolation, and then some of it very, very playful. My younger daughter she did a focus group that essentially she self-invented a pro wrestling character for herself. And so, you know, invented backstory. So was doing writing and then like creating a costume. So sewing and face painting. And then on the kind of movement theatrical side, like, you know, creating a kind of demonstration of her skills. So there was just like a very funny, you know, sequence. And then my older daughter, you know, she was in a group that was designing books. And so very different, much more reflective kind of work, which was writing and drawing and collaging. So anyway, that gives you a flavor, but I think, you know, it was just really, really fun to kind of re-engage on those kinds of, you know, much more like the pedagogical side. But they certainly, it was very successful, but it also, you know, it lacked, you know, a lot of the kind of co-invention that the camp typically produces. Yeah. Anyway, quick summary of that.
Yeah, no need to be quick either. But coming back to Brooklyn, if you're able to talk about, you know, without naming school, so the charter school, I think that you said you've been working with on a rollout plan. Could you, what were some of the early questions you got from them? What was the starting point for them around rolling out a plan? And how did that change even over the last month?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think the things that have changed since we started working with them, I think there's probably been like growing confidence that they're doing the right thing. Like even when I first engaged with them, I was pretty wary of this idea that kids should go back to school. I mean, this school, you know, a lot of kids whose parents are essential workers, you know, I would say the schools, you know, more than 90% students of color, 90% or more coming by public transportation to get there. So a lot of big questions about like, you know, at the starting point, like, is this really the right thing to do? And really wanting to be very, very careful in terms of, you know, assumptions and how to go about doing this. And so I think, you know, in terms of where we are now with them, yeah, just a lot more confidence that like, okay, you know, New York's in a much better place. And going back to school for these kids is really important. But I think a lot of things got much more nuanced, which was like, and some of the work that, you know, my firm does work related to schools, but also a lot of work in the public realm. And so really trying to understand what like using street space means. This school has a lot of special needs kids and, you know, some kids who have issues, sensory issues. And so what does it mean for kids to queue up on a sidewalk? And this space is like very close to the Manhattan Bridge, which is very noisy in terms of subways going over it. And so, you know, I think as we got deeper into it, trying to probably paring away some of the big ideas and then trying to deal with and address some of the more basic concerns, you know, where, you know, we started was, which unfortunately is sort of where the city's going now with, but it's gonna be too late for many places to like, how do you do outdoor classrooms? You know, like the city has just announced like this week, you know, like a week and a half or 2 weeks before school starts, like, oh, outdoor classrooms are great and PTA should work towards creating them. And I talk to a lot of people in schools who are sort of tossing their hands into the air and trying to really figure out how they're going to do this now. But I think where we started a few months ago was like, let's think about outdoor classrooms as part of this. And then just feeling like really getting pushed back by bureaucracies at that time. Like, you know, you can't take street space and, you know, lots of concerns around permitting. And so we started with like big vision, but also very nervous about like all the health concerns, obviously still very concerned about that, to now where like the vision got a bit more focused, you know, let's not try and do outdoor classes. Let's really just focus on getting kids in and out of the school. Let's make it work with a schedule so kids come in and other kids come out and they don't run into each other. Let's make sure that, you know, that we have the timing figured out. Let's make sure that kids don't feel like they're crowded up against the street, you know, where there's cars moving and there's a lot of sound. So those were, you know, I guess a lot of pragmatic shifts, but also a lot of like, let's meet the basic needs of kids as best we can.
Can you pick out profiles of say 3 or 4 students and or teachers who plans evolved most around?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think we were getting information sort of anecdotally from staff administration. So we weren't, initially when we started, we did interact a bit with students and more with teachers, and we're trying to kind of, you know, again, when we're in an early visioning process, I'm not sure I could build out a profile of 3 or 4 prototypical students. We were definitely assuming that they were traveling in by subway, you know, or by bus. So trying to understand where they were coming from, trying to understand early on, and that talking to families and kids was going to school was sort of something that starts the second you leave your door and not the second you enter the building. So that's something that I don't think schools have ever really focused on much, you know, and now like we all need to, like, I think we all have a different appreciation of the journey to school and what it means now, assuming you're not doing it virtually. So I don't know if it was 3 or 4 prototypical students, but that was the one that we were very focused on, you know, was, you know, they need to like have a kind of sense of thresholds. You know, you have your door, you have going down into the subway, you have going into the subway car, you have going into the school building. So, you know, trying to get kids to think about how to act at each threshold, you know, and their behavior at each threshold. That was discussions from early on that I think was really fascinating and important, you know, and like with our kids too. And probably, do you have kids?
No.
No. So, you know, but that is like such a thing now that you probably experience it, right? Like your life is sort of segmented by these thresholds that you cross and the kind of behavior adaptation for each. So that, you know, so that was a part of our early conversations with kids and recognizing that, you know, some kids, they have many more thresholds to cross to get to school, you know, and whether it's distance or it's public transportation, you know, or in this case, a charter school where the building is not just theirs, they share it with office space. So that has its own complexities to it as well. You know, for the staff, very young, so I'd probably generalize about this staff a little bit, you know, not, you know, charter school staff don't need to be unionized. They tend to be younger. I don't think have had the struggles that the Department of Education has had, because that has a union with a lot of teachers that are older and have a lot of health concerns. Certainly this staff is aware and concerned for their own health. But I think that was a kind of general picture of the staff that we worked with, that they were younger and that they perhaps weren't as concerned as older staff at the Department of Education have been. So they have had a willingness to like do the temperature checking, you know, help with the queuing up of kids. And so that was a big aspect of it, which was like, to what degree is the staff starting to shift their roles and their level of comfortability doing it? And the ones we talked to seemed comfortable doing it. But, you know, I think everybody's doing things that they weren't expecting to be doing, and there are comfort zones associated with that. And there are sort of degrees of training and responsibility associated with that. And then there's also time and commitment challenges with that as well. So that, I guess, was another feature of our staff conversations. But they seem to have taken to it really well. We did a whole demonstration. I sent Suzanne and Jenny, I think, like a news clip where the news crew came out and filmed this sort of demonstration of, like, you know, people queuing up and sort of demonstrating how that will work. And of course, all of this is like, you know, we all need to practice what it's like to be in this world. Like my younger daughter is, you know, right now, at least, she's planning on going back to school 2 days a week, and it's a new school. And so there will be these challenges of like learning to socialize with kids with masks on, and there'll be these challenges of getting to know teachers, you know, with masks on, and teachers having to be focused on and concerned about all of these other things as well.
Way back in March and April, I remember this phrase going around about what the new normal would be like, and you know, that phrase carries a lot of different meanings now. And I'm wondering where it has landed with you as you work on all of these different projects and plans and the types of issues that come up, patterns, behaviors, what people are used to, what they're not used to, what they have to adapt to. What is the new normal mean at this point for you? Not what is it, but what does it mean to you in this moment?
Yeah. I think one of the things I talked about at the first interview that I've been really interested in is that there has been this kind of segmenting of what schools do. You know, schools do a lot of things historically that have been wrapped up in one. You know, they do academic teaching, they do social learning, and then they provide social services, food and kind of shelter for kids whose parents are at work. And I feel like the new normal is sort of pulling apart those segments, which is really kind of concerning, but also maybe an opportunity, or at least something to study and learn from. You know, I think there's been a lot of talk, and we'll see how many of them get activated, these idea of kind of like, they call them learning labs. You know, some of the politicians, Jumaane Williams, has been talking about it, and you know, basically spaces that aren't necessarily in schools where kids can go, and they, you know, will probably be doing some studying there, but won't be being taught. But they're essentially providing some of that social service aspect of what schools provide, and that's you know, I think, a kind of an interesting concept. And then obviously there are kids who are going to be learning remotely. You know, more and more schools are doing that, and that's kind of the academic piece, but it's missing that social learning. And then there is this also this other opportunity, you know, where certainly for younger kids too, to start using streets and other spaces as play spaces and, you know, essentially open streets. And some of that social learning can occur there. And so it's now we're sort of broadening our notion of like, you know, how to use different spaces. And we're also starting to recognize very slowly, you know, the different needs that schools fulfill. You know, that if we're not going to have like all three things rolled up in one school, the social services, the social learning, and the academic learning, and they're going to get pulled apart, we have to find ways of providing for them. So I think I think the new normal will start to think about these things in segments a little bit. And that's, again, both challenging and an opportunity as well. You know, in some of the work that I do, which relates to integrating spaces, integrating classrooms, the idea that kids are physically or remotely in more integrated spaces is kind of more possible. You know, if you're doing things remotely, you can create an integrated classroom in a way that you couldn't before. Or if you're only going to school once a week, maybe you can travel more to create a more integrated space. So some of these notions might get challenged, or there might be opportunities for new kinds of programs that aren't schools where kids go every day, 9 to 3, that, you know, they might go less frequently and do virtual work and then go to more intentionally created spaces and groups of children. So I'm not sure that's a new normal yet, but I think the new normal is a kind of segmented understanding of schools, and, you know, and also really putting a fine point on that, you know, some kids really, really need those, the social service dimension of a school, and some kids don't need it as much because they have different support systems. And so, you know, like, just how are we grappling with those kids that do have those needs? How are we providing that, you know, is a really huge challenge, and is just much more front and center now.
Yeah, as you're talking, you know, it's really coming to the forefront that in this situation, integration and equity are quite different. They overlap, but they're pretty different. And so I'm curious how in the plans, the rollout plans that you've either worked on or seen, how does the role of equity differ now from integration in a way that might be different from before?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've always been related, but different. And I think that, you know, in terms of equity, there are so many dimensions that have been exposed by the pandemic and heightened. You know, the idea that kids, even if it's not every day now, like some kids will be going to school 2 days a week or 3 days a week, but those off days, if they are working from home, you know, the apartment needs to be a classroom. And so housing and what housing does is, you know, a part of this equity question. You know, like, kids who are in 800, 700 square foot spaces with, you know, two or three siblings, you know, just carving out the space to do things is very difficult. And, you know, this idea that, especially at the high school level, you know, kids are going to turn on their cameras, and then it's like, well, actually, what do I have in my background versus what everybody else has in their background, you know, and the noise and everything. So, you know, so it's not even just, do they have a computer? Do they have Wi-Fi? There's all those infrastructural issues. Housing is a form of infrastructure too. So the equity, you know, so, you know, those things were just, when it came to schools, those things were just not on the table in the same way they are now. Kids who have had to travel more to school don't have to travel as much. So some things have shifted, you know. I mean, there are kids in districts that we work with who are traveling like very long distances, or a lot of, you know, heavily congested, you know, bus routes or whatever to get to school. Like, some of those things, you know, have been dealt with. You know, some of the inequities of school buildings themselves isn't as big a deal because kids are working remotely. So there are different things occurring.
Like what inequities with school buildings aren't as big a deal now?
Well, I mean, if kids aren't in schools, if they're working from home, you know, I mean, you know, like definitely, well, most New York City public schools need a bit of help physically, but there are a lot of them that don't have air conditioning and, you know, they, you know, have all sorts of difficult physical conditions that should be sorted out, you know, and the air conditioning stuff now has gotten multiplied by concern about ventilation, you know, and there's definitely, it's a big issue with the teachers' unions. Like, am I really going to go into that classroom? And, you know, air is supposed to circulate at, you know, this amount per hour, but actually we all know that it's, you know, the DOE is not going to be able to invest in that.
And as a parent, what have you been paying attention to in terms of news, in terms of updates? Have you been able to participate in planning as a parent, also in your kids' schools?
Yeah, I mean, my older daughter, she goes to a public, you know, Department of Education high school in Queens. So we were pretty concerned about her traveling there. I mean, it's, you know, all subway. There was no other way we were going to get her there. We don't own a car. And so we were definitely very focused on what they were planning. The school basically said that in order to really open properly, the only way they could do it would be that for large portions of the day, kids would be sitting in classrooms doing remote learning in a classroom. And they basically said, we don't think that's a good idea. And so we're going to recommend to all the parents, unless you really have, like, you know, essential needs for your kids, that everybody goes remote. So we followed that and we felt like that was the right move. And as a high schooler, I think she's got a lot more capacity to learn remotely. She has been in that school for a year, so she's in a decent space and has kids in the neighborhood that go to that school that she'll be able to sort of work with during the school day, so she won't be super isolated. My younger daughter, as I mentioned, she's starting a new school, so like totally new community, no real knowledge of, you know, people there. But that's in walking distance. We've been just sort of like waiting. They took some time, but they had a town hall meeting where they described the different options, and we ultimately selected doing a hybrid. It was either hybrid or 100% remote, and we felt comfortable enough. And I think so far we continue to feel comfortable enough with her going in 2 days a week. And she really, really wants to, even though it's not going to be like regular school, but she's a kid who loves, you know, the school, has loved the school environment. And actually they had a meeting tonight, which, since I'm with you, my daughter and my wife are on, but that's fine. I'll get the download. So at any rate, so that, you know, we felt, you know, like I've worked a lot with the New York City Department of Education. I am pretty understanding. And so lots of people, I think, have felt very like lacking in control, left in the dark. And like, we definitely were not getting an overflow of information from the schools, especially the new school. But I kind of get it. Like, I guess I'm someone who really understands that what New York City does, for all its many faults, educating 1.1 million school children is an unbelievable feat. And they're just not gonna be able to do things as fluidly as a tiny school district or a private school or a charter school. And so I'm definitely willing to cut them some slack. And when we're on the like Zoom calls with these folks, I just see like how hard they're working and some of them also clearly feel a lack of control from the higher ups within the structure too, and are finding ways to cope with that. So, you know, it's just everybody's up against unbelievable challenges. And so I'm willing to be patient. You know, where I work, I'm working from home. I'm able to be around, you know, obviously I'd love to know that the airflow in the school was being done really well, but like, this is where we are. You know, if you interview me in 3 months, we'll see how I feel, and hopefully everybody will be healthy.
Are you able to talk at all about how information flow has actually been working? Again, without kind of naming any particular people or agencies, when does information get circulated to staff, to decision makers, to parents? How and when are decisions communicated?
I know I've been referring to agencies, so anyway, in New York City.
You're welcome to. It's just that you don't have to.
The schools themselves have been left to their own devices, kind of for better or for worse. And so the flows of information have been different, you know, between high school and middle school, in my experience. I can't speak for like the flow of information to the staff, so I don't know how that's worked. I have a feeling with the high school, you know, they made their decision earlier. Like, I think we knew, 6 weeks ago, maybe 5 weeks ago, that it was basically, they were recommended to everybody to go all remote. They held a number of evening calls, you know, Zoom calls with parents. Obviously all the information is coming by email. I don't think we received anything with a physical piece of mail. So people definitely need to be online and looking at their emails. It's been slower with the middle school. There have been sort of more options with the middle school, which has led to more kind of like hemming and hawing and debating among parents. We know some parents who are sending their kids there. I think, I know that at least one of my daughter's parents have opted to send their kid to a charter school as a result. I don't know if it's as a result of everything that's going on, but it could be tied to that, you know. So I think, you know, the way in which the Department of Education is moving as a system is definitely giving people pause for thought, parents. And so I think the enrollment numbers will be very interesting to see, you know. And a lot of my work has been, you know, working very hard to do school integration without people opting out of the system. And we had one very successful year of that in the district where I've been working, District 15. We'll see if they have the same result this year. So that'll be something to watch. But I'm working with districts across the country, and I think they're all sort of looking at their enrollment and looking at the way people are choosing. And, you know, these things, you know, they are going to have lasting effects on their systems, you know, in terms of like, it could be, you know, there will be interest in permanent virtual schooling among some kids. Some kids do better with it. You know, that may be a great thing for some districts that have no capacity in their buildings and the kids who do well with that. In other districts where I'm starting to work, it will be disastrous. They'll have school buildings that like they will have a hard time justifying staying open. And, you know, for a lot of the kids who go there, that's a really big deal because, again, of the way schools operate for many families is, you know, satisfying social services as well as social learning and academic learning. So, you know, I think there are going to be lasting effects from this that, you know, assuming that there's a vaccine in the next year or so, still things are going to continue to, you know, have this ongoing effect.
What do you anticipate happening the first 2 weeks? Where are you going to be troubleshooting as a professional and as a parent?
That's interesting. As a professional, I think I will be working with some districts on the, like, you know, in what they call enrollment projections. They tend to wait. They don't do that in the first 2 weeks. You know, in all schools, even in sort of more old normal times, they wait until October to look at what their roles are. So I think everybody's going to wait to really look at final sort of, or like kind of impression till October on those things. You know, the other work that I was doing this springtime, that's going to kick back into gear. So we will start in September to, on some of that work at least, start to re-engage people who will set us up to engage with the public. And I think all of that engagement is going to shift online. And so I actually feel pretty optimistic about engaging parents and the public virtually. I feel like it's going to give a lot more opportunity for parents to join, whereas like they had other responsibilities. And so, you know, if those sessions are managed in a certain way, like you just get a lot more involvement. And that's started to, I've seen that in other things where, you know, the turnout has been sort of increasing for things virtually. As a parent, you know, I'll just really be interested to see how my younger daughter is able to adjust socially to being in classes of 12 kids who are sitting apart wearing masks. You know, I'm just going to be really interested. And my older daughter, it's trying to see if they can keep their cameras on. Like, I think, you know, high school classes, it's really hard for like a history teacher or an English teacher to have a real discussion, you know, and high school kids, they don't want it. And so to start a new year, like at least last year she had met the teachers. Like, I was like, how are you going to meet these teachers if you don't keep your camera on? So that will be interesting to see. And then for both of them, we're definitely not doing any fancy podding, you know, stuff, but like, we want them to have a couple of friends that they can kind of study with, and, you know, so that they're able to like not just be isolated in the room. They've watched a lot of TV and played a lot of video games over the summer, which has never been to this degree before. Like, that's kind of wrenching to see. And, you know, we got to see how school can start to shift out of that gear.
And looking ahead to a year from now, what do you imagine? What do you hope? What do you imagine? What do you see at the beginning of the school year in 2021?
I mean, I think, you know, hopefully kids are able to go back and go back more or less as they were going before. I do think you'll see a lot of new enthusiasm, you know, like kids, like at the end of the day, most kids really like school. And I think, you know, there's just going to be like a real love for going back, you know, and I think the camp that I've been helping out with that I started, I think there's just going to be an explosion of energy if they're able to go back next summer. That will be amazing to see. You know, people are going to make up for some lost time. But I do think there are going to be new models of things. You know, I think there will be new virtual after-school programs that will keep going. There will be probably some new models of virtual schooling that will keep going. And hopefully, you know, people will start to realize that streets and, you know, outdoor space serve other functions besides traffic and like some of that social learning that we talked about at the beginning. Like, you know, I could see some of that happening and sticking, you know, not obviously the restaurant thing, like I think that's going to stay and proliferate. But at the end of the day, that's also about commercial use and certain age groups. And I think like starting to see some of that stuff spill out into more of our space in New York City, there's a real opportunity. I think some of that will happen, you know, in a year's time.
Adam, what else do you want to put down or have on the record that you haven't talked about or I haven't asked about? And there will be more interviews in the future, as you know, but for now, what else?
I think that's it. I mean, what I enjoyed from the kind of group discussion that I had was a real focus on the kind of social learning and social aspects of schooling. And so I think I'm interested to keep thinking more about that, you know, and thinking more about that with educators. I'm definitely trying to figure out like my fit into this work as it, you know, because I'm not an educator in quite the same way. But I'm sure I'll learn a few things along the way and probably have a different perspective next time I speak to someone.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, I'm going to stop recording.
Great.